The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day one of this six-day session here in November 2012 at Mountain Gate. And I'd like to take up a subject that is basically a universal challenge for everyone, whether or not they're in Zen practice, but it particularly is a challenge for anyone in Zen practice because it's so often something that we fail to perceive. And it has to do with perception. It has to do with misperception. There is a Dharma heir of Sheng Yen named Simon Child. He's a Britisher, and he speaks of hidden assumptions, fixed views. We can think we're really flexible. It's easy to do that. We feel like we're able to move and change and respond to situations. Now, what we don't realize is what we don't see. And it's a universal challenge to everyone. It takes many, 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 many long years of deep, committed practice to be able to get even a leg up on this challenge, because it's the nature of the human mind to make assumptions. It's called conditioning, and it leads us to karmic responses, karmic actions. We all come into this life with a history. Given that life is a continuum broken periodically by what we call death and birth, but it is something that goes on eternally. There's no beginning and there's no end. This is the ancient teaching. On the other hand, if you look at the koan about the end of the kalpa, there's another view on that as well. And it's a nice koan for us. If we go on forever, if life never ceases, then why, in the kalpa-ending fire, does it disappear? Do we disappear? Not only do we disappear, but do we go along with everything else that disappears? It's burnt up in the ending fire. But we won't get into that, other than to say that as infants, we already have some conditioning, and the conditioning comes further and further the older we get. A real marked example of that is a child that I knew in Thailand, daughter of Americans, and she had been born in Thailand, and for the first 6 weeks of her life, the servant who was hired to take care of her apparently pinched her any chance she got. And so this infant was pinched constantly. By the time I met this child, she was 3 years old and she had a baby brother, and the miscreant babysitter had been long fired. She'd only been around for 6 weeks, and it was because this little girl cried every time that woman came into her presence that her mom began to get a little suspicious. And I think she finally realized what was happening, because she's the one that told me about it. But the child at three was very, very wary of anyone other than her mother. She did not trust. that early experience before she even had words, well before she had words to describe it, was a very negative experience for her, and it colored her perception of other people. This is an extreme example of conditioning, but we all have conditioning of one sort or the other. And we draw conclusions from that conditioning. It's classic, for example, for children who are abused to assume that there's something wrong with them, that they're evil or they're bad. Otherwise, that abuse wouldn't happen to them. And sometimes the abuser helps that assumption along. But it's a natural assumption that children develop, apparently. We have, even if we weren't abused, we have developed many, many, many assumptions about things, assumptions about ourselves. We are growing up in a family of at least one person, and how that person, that adult, reacts to us, whether it's a babysitter or a parent or childcare personnel or whoever it is, they interact with us in certain ways, and we draw our own conclusions based on that interaction. Draw conclusions about ourselves, we draw conclusions about the world, we draw conclusions about other people, and we don't even realize it because so much of it is pre-verbal. But even after we are able to speak and understand words, that conditioning continues. We go to school, we go to grade school, then we go to junior high school, then we go to high school. There's been studies done of children going off to kindergarten for the first time, and they were trying to figure out why some children just marched into the strange new room with the strange new people and immediately launched into a positive experience, and others hung back, clung to their mothers, cried, and had a difficult time adjusting. They took videotapes of a number of these encounters where parents were taking their children, dropping them off at the first day of school ever, and they began to see a correlation. If the mother was weepy, if the mother was anxious about the child going off on their own, the child mirrored that. And we know now that there are such things in our brain as mirror neurons that will understand, comprehend a mind state of another person in our environment, and we will feel that mind state ourselves. And with small children, how could we understand other than that's how to be in that circumstance? If our parent is getting weepy and anxious as we're going off to school on our own, then there must be something about that that is worthy of getting weepy and anxious. And so we follow suit. This is how children learn. They learn by mimicking the behavior of adults. But along with that comes ideas, assumptions. And sometimes those ideas are pretty fixed. And when those ideas are pretty fixed, they are going to trip us up sooner or later. Our true mind is not caught in fixed ideas. Our true mind is free and functioning, one with each moment. That is our natural way to be. And what gets in the way is these ideas we've developed about ourselves and life and the world and other people, and our continuing reinforcement of those, and our continuing reinforcement of those as a result of our own ideas about ourselves. Something happens, someone says something, it reminds us of something that was said by somebody else long ago, or maybe not so long ago, and the coloration of that previous encounter comes right along with whatever was said, even though that statement did not have any inherent coloration of itself, certainly not necessarily the coloration of our own previous experience. But there it is, and we react. We get angry, we get upset, or conversely, if it was a very positive experience, we feel good. We may feel very good about ourselves. We may even get a little swelled up about it. But darn, how do you get out of these traps? How do you get out of these traps? Given that it's the nature of human beings to become conditioned, this is something that even the Buddha stated. How can we truly become free? How can we truly become free? There's a koan, the Mumon koan, that reads something like this. Why, at the sound of the bell, do you put on your seven-piece robe? And this is regarding somebody who's ordained and putting on their kesa in the morning to go to the morning chanting service or the morning sitting. Depending on whether you're Rinzai or Soto, one of them happens before the other. And you start out in your kesa, your more formal robe that goes over the regular robes if you're ordained. So why, if you're so free, if you can do anything you feel like, if you're not caught by circumstance, why, when the bell rings, why do you get up and get dressed appropriately and go into the zendo or the hondo? Why do you follow rules if you're so free? Someone who's truly free is able to follow rules without any problem because there are no ideas about them. The rules are there. They're the way it goes in the monastery, for example, or at work, for example. And they're followed naturally. But for one who's caught having to be at work at 7 o'clock in the morning or having to go through rush hour with all the challenges of travel at that point in time, can become quite irritating. We don't like it. We'd rather stay in our nice warm bed, get a few more hours or at least minutes of sleep. Why do we get up and go to work? When the alarm clock rings and it's time to be in the office. We can be sure that our time in the office or in the temple or wherever our work takes us in a given day is going to be more or less constrained, more or less challenging, more or less filled with discomfort, depending on our ideas about it. That's the bottom line. It's not what the circumstances are. And a very, very good example of that is Jacques Le Seurat in Buchenwald. One cannot imagine a more hellish place to be, where you're not even given sufficient food, where every minute somebody could go out of control, whether it's a guard, sadistic guard stabbing people, whether it's another fellow prisoner who's gone mad and is going around strangling others or beating them up. It doesn't matter. And to be sure, for the first 5 months enduring that extremely crowded conditions, which classically are known to bring out the worst in people or animals. The first experiments done were with crowded rats, and they turned on each other and those with the stress of those of that environment. The same thing happens with human beings. This is why big cities are so famous for being places where there's a lot of violence. And eventually he couldn't take it anymore. His mind wanted out. And he got sick. And he was dying. But then something happened. As he put it in the book in which he writes about his life there, I took advantage of my sickness to leave Buchenwald. What did he mean by that? He meant leaving his ideas about it behind. Tuning in totally to the experience of dying, every single cell in his body, he knew exactly what was going on. And because he was so totally present and so let go of his ideas about where he was or why he was there or how bad it was, he had a deep awakening experience and he was able to essentially permanently let go a big chunk of conditioning. And the result? The result was that he found joy. There's a statement in Zen that even garbage glitters like gold. When we can reach that kind of mind state, when we are let go enough, everything is perfect, shining, wondrous, just as it is. Even the drunk in the gutter. Even the ramshackle room without heat. Even the crowded conditions in Buchenwald, where people regularly stole his bread because he was blind. But when he let go to that degree, and it was a deep awakening because he said that the joy never left him, even though he had more than 11 months left before the camp was liberated. That says already that that Kensho was deep, that the joy would last that long. And it sounds like it stayed with him essentially the rest of his life. In those circumstances, having let go, then there was no problem being in Buchenwald. No problem at all. He wasn't getting fed anymore than he had been fed before, although at that point people stopped stealing his bread. There was still the extremely meager ration of soup, the few crusts of bread in a week. There was still the cold and the misery of the environment. But for him, not attached to any of it, none of that existed. Sure, he could write about it, he could describe it. He wasn't coming up with some Pollyanna idea of where he was. He knew very well where he was. He knew very well it was a hell realm. But, as it said elsewhere in Zen, he was able to travel through the six realms in a samadhi of innocent delight, even into the hellish realm of Buchenwald. And not only that, he was able to be of deep assistance to people who were freaking out, because he was able to be so deeply peaceful, so completely let go, that that mind state could be expressed and felt by others. He had let go his hidden assumptions, his fixed views about where he was and who he was. We have our practice. We have the susukkan, the extended out-breath, which is magical in terms of reaching that mind state. When it's difficult for us, when we're bumping up against those hidden assumptions, fixed views, we don't even recognize they're there, but we only could say that it's really crappy right now. We want to get the hell out of here. Why did we ever start Zen practice to begin with? Everything is feeling like it's threatening in some way. We got to get out of here. We got to leave. Just for our own sanity. Well, sometimes the leaving wants to go by going inside. When we are suffering, we are far more willing to go beyond ourselves. not that Zen seeks to create suffering. We certainly have enough of it ourselves. We don't need anything extra. We can manufacture our own quite efficiently, thank you very much. But when it comes, when we're feeling very down, when we're feeling angry, when we're feeling irritated, when we're feeling up to the gills with everything we can manage to take, then to seek deeply, who is it? Who is it that feels like this? Who is it that wants to get out of here? Who is it that's frustrated? Who is it that's angry? Who is it that thinks the teacher is totally wrong and abusive to boot? Who is it? Who is it? Who is it? There can be deep advantages to not being able to leave. And of course, as we already said, it's not about trying to make people feel bad. It's not trying to make people reach a point of near self-destruction so that they can go deep. That doesn't have to be done. We do it ourselves without any external help. But to use it then, to use it, to be wary of our fixed views, to be wary of our ideas, to be wary of our condition, to be wary of our assumptions. Are they really accurate? Maybe they're not. This practice could not have survived more than 2,500 years if all it did was abuse people. It doesn't abuse people. We do that to ourselves. And we'll do that to ourselves whether we're in a zendo, in a training hall, out and about in work, in our family, in life. If that conditioning is there, we'll have moments of peace and joy and happiness and moments of real challenge. And we'll find ourselves acting out of our conditioning, often without realizing it even. Somebody said something to us at a point in our life and it hurt. And somebody years later who may look like that person or feel like that person or unwittingly says something similar, the hurt is already there. And the reaction is strong because of it. Who is this true person of no rank coming in and out of the doors of the senses? See it now. See it now. See it now. Nobody, particularly not Zen teachers, that I know at least, like to see people suffer, want to see people suffer. It's our business to help people become free of suffering, not to suffer more. The practice is here. It's up to each one of us to take it and give it everything we've got so that we can realize the truth of non-suffering, so that we can become free, so that no matter what our life circumstances are, even if we can't escape, that we can use them to free ourselves and to live each moment imbued with our innate compassion and wisdom. This is what Zen practice is about. We all have the capacity to make it that. It is my deep, deep wish that we all do so. There's enough suffering in the world. We don't need any more. Thank you for listening, and we'll stop now and recite the four vows.